Harold has to say about that. Harold, do you believe that Rich should write it up, or do you think Collins has already covered that subject? And it's probably a website that allows us to see all of those Collins bulletins. DPZ, RIW.
RIW, DPZ. I believe there was a bulletin about the ALC zeroing problem. But the problem is the Phillips tubes are not the greatest tubes, and their gain factors are very different to some, let's see, RCA-GE or Sylvania tubes. And you do have to put some compensation if you want to use it. And if Rich wants to write up a little note on it, it sure wouldn't hurt, as far as I'm concerned. Everybody gives a better suggestion on something is valuable. Go ahead, Dick.
Now, let me ask you this question, though, Harold. Where is the website by which a person could read all of these past Collins bulletins? Take a person like Rich, who's heavy into Collins restoration and love of that particular rig. Where, if I suddenly wanted to acquire that that passion, what website would I go to read these past Collins bulletins? Or would I have to go to your house and read all your notes? Over to you, Howard.
Collins Collectors Association has a website. You can bring it up on the internet. There's a vast amount of information there dealing with Collins, from S-lines to you name it, all the Collins going all the way back, and the KWM 380s.
How about that? Okay, back to you, Rich, for any further comments, and to Echo Oscar, the guy who brought us this question, K2RAW.
Okay, Dick, and good evening, Alan, Bernie. Anybody else at 2EO. No, I'm aware of the Collins Collectors Association, Collins Radio Association. Those are the two. I thought maybe I was the only one having the problem. But I'd like to ask Mel, and then we can go on to the next person. Mel, do you happen to know what bulletin number, so I can look it up, dealt with 688 in the ALC circuit on the KWM-2A. Again, the tube is C4. Back to you, Jake.
Yeah, I think we should ask both Mel and Harold in that order for which Collins bulletin number. Mel first, you got a Mel.
Oh, boy, I wouldn't know the number of the bulletin offhand, but if you go to the Collins Collectors Association and go down the line, you'll find it. I mean, I don't know if it was like a specific number on the bulletin. I think it may have been just one of the bulletins. Hal, maybe he's more familiar with it than I am. Well, Dan, I haven't looked at that in a long time over.
Okay, K6DPZ, do you happen to know which bulletin number? And by the way, when you go to the Collins Collectors Association and you look at all those bulletins, sure would be nice if they're cross-reference by either subject or alphabetical or whatever, making it a little bit easier for Rich to find that particular bulletin. You got it, Harold. K2RIW.
K2RIW in the group, K6DPZ. I don't remember that bulletin number right offhand. I'm sitting in my car, and I chose to not keep everything to memory, Dick. But if Richard calls me, I'll try and pull up the stuff if he doesn't have it handy.
Yeah, but you're a Collins collector from way back. You're supposed to have that in the notebook that you carry with you every day so that people can get this information from you. And, you flip to the right page of your notebook as a Collins aficionado. I'm pulling your leg here, Harold. Okay. I mean, there's passions and there's passions. There are people who really fall in love with a particular rig. You've heard me often talk about my Kenwood TS711A all-mode 2-meter rig, which is, I think, one of the finest pieces of equipment that Kenwood ever produced. You heard me brag about my Drake R4C receiver with that noise blanker, that FET noise blanker stage, an add-on. So what's so magic about that is that the noise blanker is in front of the IF strip. It cuts off the pulse before it gets a chance to ring up the IF. See, a super heterodyne receiver, the IF strip is where the real tuning takes place. Well, the good news about a narrowband tuner in your IF strip is that you've got nice deep skirt. And it's got a tunable IF, by the way. A mechanically tunable IF, not electronically. But the good news is that it's got nice sharp skirts to it. But anything that's got narrow band, it's got high Q, and therefore it'll ring like a bell. So a pulse of energy that comes through the IF strip, at the end of the IF strip, you try to clip it off, and it's too late. The energy has already been stored. And the magic of their noise blanker is that it blanks off the spike of energy by way of a delay line. It has preconceived information. I can't think of the name of the characteristic we talk about, where a circuit knows what's going to happen before it happens, cuts off the signal before it gets there, so to speak. The IF strip never gets a chance to ring on the spike of energy. That's part of what makes it work so well. That particular blanker, as you heard me talk about before, will take out a signal, a spiky signal, 120 decibels above threshold. It takes it out so thoroughly, you don't hear it at all. Oh, man, was that a blanker. Is that a blanker? But that's a tube rig, and I got to worry about those tubes wearing out, so to speak. I mean, vacuum tubes have a finite life to them. They eventually get gassy, and all kinds of nasty things happen. So will I still be able to buy the beautiful tubes that are in a Drake R4C receiver when I want to need that on some experiment some particular day? It's something I got to worry about. I'd like to believe that somebody has come up with solid-state equivalents for many of those tubes that are in the Drake R4C. I know my luck will be that not all of them have got that, and maybe they not all have the same characteristics. Okay, of all the people who signed in, according to my list, the next person who gave me a yes was Paul, WS2N. Paul can give us a question, a space report, whatever. I know that, let's see, although it's not exactly space-related, the CERN collector, the CERN collider in Europe, we all know, many of us know that has had a failure of its magnets. That's going to be off the air for like 6 months. Can't be turned on until next spring when there's enough power locally to charge those magnets after they do all the repairs. But that's the normal startup procedure of a great big machine like that. The superconducting magnets, so the 27 miles of them. What a 27 kilometers. What a machine. Okay, Paul, I'm going to turn it over to you. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, one more thing, K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I knew I had something here, but I found it. on the 6ACA column, original specification calls for a transconductance on the 6ACA as Collins uses it. At 4,800, the transconductance measurement, 4,800 on the minimum mu triode, the sharp cutoff tempo, 3,300, and the remote cutoff pentode at 6,000. That was the specification that Collins designed it around, so they gave you those numbers. So that Collins Collective Net Association provided that, so you can use that for measuring if you want to use replacement stick over.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Go ahead, Hal.
Yeah, the gain factor, transconductance, very critical in that stage. Also, Dick, I just wanted to say, don't worry about tubes. They'll be here long after we're gone. So don't worry about modifying your Drake equipment to solid state.
I am worried. Maybe I'm going to live a whole lot of years. Although, as I get older and I get creaking joints and other kinds of aging problems, there are days when I think it's not going to be that long. And picture this, Harold. Picture a guy up his tower, strapped in with a bunch of safety harnesses, saying, is this the proper operation for a man of my age? And can you imagine me taking the radio on my chest and hollering Mayday to the local fire department, saying, hey, I'm stuck at the top of the tower, hanging from the harness, and because of my medical condition that's just developed, I can't climb down. Can you guys come up and get me? And I know that my tower in the woods would be difficult for them to get their hook and ladder. A man would have to climb the tower with all kinds of mountaineering equipment to get me down. And so I've asked my local fire department and the surrounding fire department, how many of you guys are equipped to do that kind of a rescue? And I get some funny looks on their faces. So you tell me I shouldn't worry about the tubes. I'm going to turn it back to you, Harold, for any further comments on that. KQRIW. By the way, are you telling me there's lots of brands, lots of sources of tubes? As long as I'm willing to pay for them, I think you're saying they're going to be around for another 30 years. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K6DPZ. They will be around a long time, longer than some of these new sets solid-state devices, you can't get after 2-3 years. Gentlemen, I have to leave at the moment. Go ahead, Dick.
Alrighty. Harold, are you the guy I could call if I need a rescue? That was a joke. Alrighty. Now I'm going to turn it over to Paul. WS2N, Paul, tell us about anything about what's going on in science and space and whatever question you've got. We're kind of late tonight, so you can even throw in a question if you want to. You can see if you can stump the experts. WS2N, T2RIW.
W2EW, can't comment.
I hear a comment out there, Dick. I think it's Eugene.
Yeah, go ahead with your comment, Eugene.
Okay, W2EWK. Listen, Dick, I got my ladder hooked up to my car. Do you allow me to come to your QTH to help you down from your tower?
Yeah, you could do that. There's another approach also, Eugene. You could come over and help me. And we'll tie a rope around my waist. We'll let the rope drape down to the ground. You'll hold on to the other end of the rope. And if I start to fall, you can pull me down slow. Is that all right, Eugene?
Affirmative, Dick. I'll be there. Just make sure you have some pizza and some Coca-Cola. I shall be there. W2EWK clear.
Okay. That's an attractive offer. I'm going to consider that. WS2N, you got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, he's going to lower you up, I guess. Very, very good. The Large Hadron Collider, yeah, less than 24 hours they had a failure in one of their coils around that 17-mile circumference ring. So that's now out of business. People won't have to worry about the black hole occurring and eating up the Earth. We'll hear about it again when they start it up a few months from now, I guess. I think it's going to be down until, like you said, spring. I just wanted to mention the Hubble Space Telescope was supposed to go up in October this month to repair the Hubble. Hubble has got its problems. This will be the fifth rescue mission, the service mission. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. Originally, it was a 4-day delay because of problems from Hurricane Kyle that went through Texas. They needed some support equipment and things from that area. And it was only a 4-day delay, and now it looks like it's going to be a delay until February, but not due to anything on Earth. The Hubble has a failure in its ability to transmit data back to Hubble Control. So there's some kind of major failure there. They have a way to do it. They're going to have them turn on. Kind of a redundant system to those who are kind of worried about their cats, about those cats. So what they need is a new system to go up with the 7 astronauts to go up with something like that. They don't have enough for them to say that it is. They are going to add that to the service mission. I wanted to mention the Phoenix mission, which has been up there for 5 months sitting on Mars, landed on Mars. It's been a 3-month mission, a little over 5 months. They have a laser detector on board that you can laser straight up into the air. And utilizing the laser and the overhead spacecraft that's orbiting Mars, such as the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, combined it gets two pieces of data when they do it from one that's overhead, and they can tell a lot about the atmosphere. Turns out they found snow coming down from some of the clouds on Mars. No, it's not making it to the Mars surface. It is pretty interesting for the scientists to detect
snow coming down. Cloud 6. The mission is still proceeding. They found a calcium carbonate, which is like a chalk type material on the surface along the way. And they say that the material will only be derived from liquid water. They have found frozen ice on the landing area, but whether this stuff has been frozen ice has been defrosted in recent times, that's still unknown. But at one point, it had to be to create calcium carbonate and ice. And this all comes out of this guy Peter Smith. He's in charge of all the science. Comes out of the University of Arizona. So they use the they have a Tiger analyzer on board and a Mecker. The Tiger is the thermal valve gas analyzer. That's one you hear about a lot with the stoves, eight stoves on board that they can use when they heat it through all their chemistry. They can figure out what they put into the stove using the big mechanical arm. I thought was interesting about this whole mission, years ago on the Mars Polar Lander, planned mission to Mars that eventually crashed into Mars, a lot of fans were excited, I know I was, they had a microphone on board and they were going to listen to Mars, the wind, or anything they could hear, they were actually going to turn it on during the landing. But now they're getting toward the end of the mission. Turns out they do have a microphone on board on this mission. I couldn't find anything about it when it first went up, when it landed in May. But I did find that they now have a microphone. I didn't know they had it, so they're going to turn it on and try to listen to any kind of air moving past the lander or maybe the machinery of the actual lander itself. Who knows what? They're getting toward the end, and they're going to put that microphone on. And when I say the end, because they're running out of sun. You know, landed in the northern latitude, and the sun hasn't been below the horizon. It's been always daytime, so they always have plenty of power for the solar panels. It's kind of like being up in Alaska, you know, where the sun doesn't set. And now, for the last, month or so, they've been losing the sun for about 4 hours, dropping below the horizon. So, they're eventually going to get to the point where they're going to lose all power, well, quite a bit of power, and they expect the arm will probably shut down at the end of October. Won't have enough power to drive it. But that's the story. Thought I'd bring up those couple of topics. We'll turn it back to you, Dick. This is WSUI.
Very fine, Paul. Engine signal came through very nicely. This is the Technical Net with K2KEY Mel and K2RIW. And you're listening to Technical Net number 1208 of the series that began in September of 1982. So we're in our 26th year. 26th year in 1 month, roughly, this particular Technical Net. Rather long-running one by my standards. Both the fact that we get close to 4 hours on Sunday nights these days, as far as, and also 27 consecutive years, with approximately 49 or 50 tech nets per year. We miss one or two weekends, maybe three occasionally. Most of the time, Mel or I are here to carry the thing on. When it comes to the Hubble Space Telescope, the report that I read, Paul, was that the transmitter that downlinks the data from the camera seems to have failed, or the circuitry that derives the data that goes into that transmitter, and they're going to spend the next month or so slowly take each one of the stages, each one of the modules of the Hubble, and telling it to go to the backup system. They were a bit reluctant to do that for two or three reasons in the report I read. Number one is the backup system has never been turned on except during a test before launch, which was way back in, 1992, I think it was, 16 years ago? Was it 1990? But when I turn it back to you, Paul, you can tell me the year of launch of Hubble. So it's in that length of time that the backup system has not been used. Second of all, once they go to the backup system, there's no other backup beyond that. And I think the method by which they get to the backup system does not allow them to get forward again to the primary system. So you lose some of the options when you go there. But because the repair mission is now going to be more extensive in order to repair not only the to replace the camera and boost it to a higher orbit and do all the other things that they do on each Hubble repair mission, but they're also going to be replacing transmitting hardware, as I see it, data assembly and transmitting hardware. When it comes to the LHC, Large Hadron Collider at CERN, there were a small number of people saying that, hey, this is the most amount of energy that's ever been put in a collision within a collider, a particle accelerator, and there were people speculating that that's going to make a black hole. First of all the black holes that exist in space have more than three solar masses. In other words, each black hole has more than three times the mass of the sun, three solar masses. And obviously, the particles inside of that particle accelerator ain't going to come close to that. Second of all, when it comes to the amount of energy that the LHC can create, it's extremely small compared to what Mother Nature is doing every single day to this Earth. There are cosmic rays that hit this Earth periodically that have an amount of energy way beyond what the LHC can create. That's been going on for 4.5 billion years on this particular planet, and it hasn't created a black hole. To which the first person would say, okay, if the cosmic rays hitting the Earth are already at that power level and way beyond, why bother building an LHC? And the answer is obvious. You can't control when and where. In the case of the LHC, you know exactly where the collision is going to take place. You've got this massive detector that's bigger than your house located there at the two spots on the ring where the collisions take place. They collect all those particles and evaluate them as to how many nanoseconds they did what and how many conversions they did and what path they took and what energies they've got and how many of them were there and so on. Those massive detectors that give you all that kind of data. If you knew where to put that detector assembly and you knew when it's going to happen, you could say, okay, Mother Nature, give me a cosmic ray right there and then. You know damn well Mother Nature's not going to do that. By the same token, if I wanted to do a high-energy experiment with very large amounts of current, I could build myself some great big capacitors with a lot of voltage on them, and I could short them out and create a current spike of a few thousand or maybe even 100,000 amperes. A lightning bolt that hits in the northern Pacific easily hits 250,000 amperes and beyond. So Mother Nature creates lightning bolts way beyond what we can create in any of our machinery. That's the good news. The bad news is you don't know where she's going to do it and when she's going to do it. So if you want to do that kind of an experiment, you're going to have to build a laboratory that makes that spike of energy because you can't figure out when and where. You can't put your machinery in the right place at the right time. You can put your machinery in some particular place and wait until it happens in that place. And you make it one event in 50 years. And the Large Hadron Collider, you're going to get millions of events per second, and you're going to collect all of those data, all of those chunks of data of all of those individual events, looking for the one that happens once per 10 billion events. You're looking for that rare one where you can see the that funny boson or whatever it is, the particles they're looking for. Let's see now. Calcium carbonate on Mars, I heard about that one. Phoenix, I think you said, is extended from 3 months to 5 months, getting good data. So I guess NASA has extended that one. And I'll turn it back to you, Paul, for any comments on some of the speculations I just said. WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N, and the microphone on the Phoenix, man. I want to hear something, anything. I want to hear a gear move or something, although that's probably highly unlikely. Everything is so looped up with that equipment. Whatever they send up there is really doing the right job. Maybe we can hear the dirt hit the top of the Tiga, the other, something, anything. I want to hear something come from a couple of Moths. But, yeah, 1990 was the Hubble launch. It launches on the space shuttle. And as far as the black holes, people were worried about that. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a movie on, it's a repeat that's been shown before, made for TV, I think. It was called Black Hole, and it was an atom smashing somewhere, and created this black hole scenario. So sometimes you wonder if they really get pumped up from the sci-fi fans or something. But maybe that's how those rumors get started. I don't know. Ampere's, I read, it sounded small, Dick, to me. Maybe you could tell me what you think. Ampere's on the Large Hadron Collider. I read 10,000 amps. Doesn't sound like much to me. Say a tremendous amount of power is going into this when this thing is on. So I was like expecting a million amps or something. Just wonder what your thought is on that, Dick. Back to your WS.
Now, when you're talking about amperes, I'm pretty sure you're not talking about the number of protons, their charge, that are in the actual beam. And you could, an ampere is defined as a coulomb's worth of electrons, which I think is 10 to the 19, 1.6, or 6.0, 6.2 times 10 to the 19 electrons passing one particular portion of a circuit in 1 second. That's 1 ampere. And so the beam itself in the LHC doesn't have very many amperes. I think it's microamperes. Now, when it comes to the amperes of 440 volts or whatever at 50 hertz that runs the machine from the local power company, that's what maybe you're referring to. The amperes of raw power that go into the machine itself to run it. I know that the total current required to run the power supplies to charge the superconducting magnets is a huge amount, and the local power company, I think in the wintertime, cannot tolerate that. You've got to give the local power company months of forewarning, and I think it's not until next spring when they're going to be given authorization to do that. So I wonder which amperes you're referring to, but when it comes to really big currents, a lightning bolt can make a really fierce amount of current. Those super lightning bolts they get in the northern Pacific are so violent that they put out a number of gamma rays that cause false alarms of the Vela satellites that we put up in space that were put up there to measure bursts of gamma rays indicating that somebody is violating a nuclear test ban treaty. And it was those Vela satellites that determined that the what are they called now? Can't even think of the name of these bursts that we have in space that happen roughly once per month, really big ones, gamma ray bursts. Mother Nature way out there in some of the galaxy is making gamma ray bursts that we can see periodically that represent an amount of energy equal to the total energy you get out of the sun in 10 billion years of life of our sun. You can get that amount of energy emitted by a gamma ray burst in 1 second. That's a really big bang, and maybe even bigger than the bang that we often refer to when we talk about the Big Bang. And scientists and astronomers and astrologers, not astrologers, astrophysicists are slowly conceding that there probably wasn't one single Big Bang, and there's multiple interpretations of that. Is there one single universe, like we used to think there's one solar system, and we thought there's one galaxy, and we thought there's a local cluster of four galaxies in the local group, and we thought there's one universe? Well, they're long beyond the point of talking about multiple universes, multiverses, as they call them. And I think you guys have heard my theory quite often stated, where the perimeter of our universe, the material, is not slowing down and coming back, it is speeding up. And I'm convinced the material at the perimeter of our observable universe is being sucked over the hill into the adjacent universe. For us to sit here and think there's only one universe and we just happen to be in the middle of it, would take quite a bit of arrogance to think that that's the way the whole thing was set up. You may think so, but I suspect we're not quite that important, and we're not in the center of it all, and we're not the only one. Back to you, Paul, for any further comments on whatever I just said. WS2N, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. The amperage for this thing, I've read that it was only 10,000 amps. I mean, they said a tremendous amount of amperage, and they said 10,000 amps. Article on the internet. I wonder if they had that right. I would be expecting, a million amps or something to run the, all these magnets. That's what really heating up all your power. You've got a tremendous amount of power going through all these thousands of magnets surrounding the 17-mile ring. And also the cryogenics, you've got gigantic compressors cooling everything down to trying to get it down to absolute zero, as close to it as possible. I heard numbers of 4 degrees Kelvin, something like that. I mean, these things aren't even running on the so-called room temperature absolute zero. They have the capability of getting it, having a high temperature. They're way down. They're trying to keep this thing very cold. They're afraid of any rise. They need that. That little area to play with. If it goes up too high, the coils will start having resistance, and it would be a runaway effect. They call that a quench problem. And all of a sudden, it'll go way up, and that will throw the beam out. This beam is shooting trillions of protons around it. 11,000 times per second it's going around the 17-mile circumference ring, and it would blow right through it. And by the way, that's why this thing is on the ground. If they do have an accident, it's not going to go shooting off to take out some house in Geneva somewhere. Also, the radiation there. When it's on, there's a lot of radiation. Nobody's allowed to be walking near the pipe with things running around. One's going around one direction, the other one's going around the other direction. So I also wanted to mention the detectors here. These things are as big as huge buildings. It's unbelievable. I've seen pictures of that inside of these gigantic detectors. They're bigger than a house, maybe about five houses. Yeah, I mean, very big. And there's four on each one. I don't know, four must be the magic number. That's what they have at Brookhaven Labs on the RIC program, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider program that we have at Brookhaven Labs. And that ring is 2.5 miles. I've been out there. It seems like forever to go around it. I can't imagine it. It's 17 miles out of the mansion that they have out in Switzerland. Actually, part of it's in Switzerland, the other one's in France. Let me turn it back to you, Dick. This is WS.
KC2OAS. KC2OAS, I think it is. Obo Alpha Sierra. Sorry for your name, sir, and then your question or comment.
Hi, Dick. This is Fred, KC2OES, and I just recently saw that program on the Science Channel. I believe it's called Beyond Tomorrow, about that collider.
Give us a few words on what you saw in that program, Fred.
It was large, to say the least. I think it was like a three-story or four-story building, just the two detectors where the gap is there. It's many miles. I forget how many miles it was, but it was an interesting program. They compared Brookhaven also in the same program.
Yeah, let me ask a quick question to Paul, who's been out to Brookhaven. The big machine they had at Brookhaven a few years ago was called the AGS, Alternating Gradient Synchrotron. And now there's a machine called the RIC. Was portions of the AGS made into the RIC, or is the RIC a second, thoroughly separate machine? Back to you, Paul.
I thought the AGS, wasn't that the, that was a linear accelerator. upgraded from the previous one. I remember in the 80s that they had there. No, the threat program's still there. That hasn't changed. The name hasn't changed. It was originally called Isabel. Isabel was another acronym. And they were going to put that up probably in the very early 80s. And then they lost funding on that and sat idle for, oh, I don't know, 5-8 years or so. And then they got the funding and continued the project, changed everything, changed everything, except for the ring. They didn't change that. That's 8.5 miles in circumference. And they called it the RIC program. So, they've got linear accelerators out there in different locations. Nothing like this thing. They start off, remember that they used gold proton out at Brookhaven. They start out, they separate the electrons out. Once they get that moving, it goes through every, small accelerator, these rings, and then they eventually start going for larger and larger rings, and eventually they wind up in this big super ring. And they have a similar process out at CERN. And when they get these things going, they actually use the radio frequencies on the outside of the detectors to accelerate to give these things more energy. And to get them going faster and faster, and you wind up with terabolt numbers or whatever they are. To get it, unbelievable. That's how they figure out the power by how many terabolts they have. The bigger the machine, physically, the bigger the compass, the deviant, the arc on each, turning is as tight, and they can make these things go faster and faster. So the bigger the better when it comes to this type of equipment. It's kind of like telescopes, I know that. The bigger the telescope, the more you can see. Well, when it comes to the atom smashers, one going one way and the other one going the other way, the bigger the better thing. That's pretty much what I know about it. I know we're still operating on Long Island. There's another one out. I think Stanford University has one, and then another big one in Fermilab in Illinois, near Chicago somewhere. Back to there.
Yeah, I think Fermilab is Batavia, Illinois, but I'm not positive on that one. In the case of the cryogenics used on the superconducting magnets at the CERN's Large Hadron Collider, current flowing through a coil of wire makes a magnetic field. So in theory, you could make a real strong magnet by putting a lot of current through a wire, but that takes a real big power supply, and the wire gets hot with the current flowing through it, through the resistance. So if you're smart enough to use superconducting materials for the wire of the coil, then the current will flow through it with no voltage drop and no heat is generated. And if you're really smart, you pump current into that coil, you close the loop, and the current keeps flowing, the magnetic field stays there, and you don't have to have a power supply to maintain it. However, that requires a pretty fancy cryogenics. You start off with liquid helium at 77 Kelvin in the outer insulating of that superconducting wire, and the inner insulating is operating at the liquid helium. Liquid helium boils off at 4 degrees Kelvin. So there are some nice superconducting materials that can tolerate very large amounts of current. Each superconducting material, depending on the nature of the material, depending on the temperature it's operating at, determines what current you can flow through the wire before it loses superconductivity. Every superconducting wire is only superconducting up to a particular current or current density, I'm not sure which. And so they've got these zillion superconducting magnets on the LHC because they want a very strong magnetic field to bend that beam, and as the beam gets moving faster and faster, it develops more and more centrifugal energy, centrifugal force. It requires a stronger and stronger magnet to bend the beam, to keep it into the circle, to keep it focused, and eventually you run into the limit where that's the maximum magnetic field you can create. and maximum magnetic field requires a lot of current in the coils, and the coils better be superconducting, otherwise you ain't got enough local power to maintain that. And when you lose the cryogenics, that's what I think happened. I believe there was either a liquid nitrogen or a liquid helium leak that occurred in the system. A pipe apparently developed a leak. The cryogenics was lost, and therefore a particular magnet got quenched. The coil started developing resistance. The current flowing into it was being dissipated, and the magnet gave them what you and I would call an inductive kickback. If you've ever decided to measure a great big power transformer by putting your ohm meter on the low ohm scale across the primary winding, many of us have run into this condition where with your fingers you hold each of the two wires of the primary against the two probes of your ohm meter on the times one scale. You watch the meter slowly move over to one side. If it was a Dawson dial movement like you've got on your old-fashioned Simpson or triplet volt ohm milliammeters that we also used to use, you would watch the needle slowly move over toward the low ohm scale as the magnetic field in the transformer, in the primary winding, built up. The way your ohm meter works is it's pumping current across an unknown resistor. Depending on the voltage drop across the resistor, the scale reads out ohms. If, for instance, it was a 1-ohm resistor, and if your particular ohm meter pumped 1 ampere of current through its two probes, obviously by ohm's law, you'd have 1 volt drop across that resistor. And your meter would measure 1 volt, but the meter would be calibrated as 1 ohm in that particular spot. Well, if you've ever done that with an old triplet or Simpson, which really did put out, I think, I'm going to pick a number, 150 milliamps or something like that, a substantial amount of current on the times one scale. You do that on your transformer, you watch the needle slowly settle over to a couple of ohms on the primary winding, you're measuring the fact that there's no shorts or opens or whatever, and then the next thing that happens is you decide, okay, the test is over, I'm going to open up my fingers and let the lead of the transformer disconnect from the probe of the volt ohm milliammeter. You do that and you watch a spark happen and your hand jumps because the inductive kickback of the transformer produced a 1,000-volt spike that was across your hand that kept your attention. I've run into that experiment a couple of times. So now on, when I do that experiment, I make sure the two wires of the transformer are laying on a wooden table and I'm holding on to the two insulated plastic sections of the probe and I'm not touching those wires. I've learned the hard way. So an inductive kickback, you have stored energy in that magnetic field, and all that energy is going to come back at you when the magnetic field starts collapsing. In the case of a quenched magnet on the LHC, that quenching process probably creates a lot of local heat and voltage and current flow and whatever in those coils as the quenching procedure begins, and it might even potentially do some funny things to the adjacent magnet. So I did hear the story that two magnets side by side both failed in this particular incident. They're going to warm up the whole machine, at least in that section, do an analysis, do a repair, put it all back together again, fix the leak, start cryogenically cooling it again slowly, and eventually pumping current back into it to bring the magnetic field of the superconducting magnet back up. It is my guess that they're going to maintain the magnetic field and all of the other magnets on the ring. There's very little reason to quench all of those and go through the recharging process. Fun type machine. Really big machine. My guess is you saw some pretty big hardware when you were at Brookhaven Lab during one of those open houses, Paul. And can you imagine the LHC, which is probably, what, 10 times bigger than the one that you saw? I remember walking around the ring 15, 20 years ago of the alternating gradient synchrotron, which I believe was a 1 mile circumference accelerator. And I believe that that accelerator is now one of the lower energy stages of the RIC. I think they started off with the Cockcroft-Walton accelerator, a linear accelerator, which goes into a small ring, which goes into a bigger ring, which goes into the HES, which probably goes into an intermediate ring, which goes into the RIC. I think all of those machines are cascaded in that manner. That's my guess. So can you imagine how big that machine is there at CERN, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, that might be one of the rings before it gets into the big ring. There were like three or four of them. Each one got up to a higher and higher voltage, let's call it. That's what they call it. And well, you know, I went out there. You know, I was just sent out to, we were installing some refrigeration equipment in one building, an air conditioning system in another. A little heating system in one of the tech areas, but nothing to do with the science of it, although I like it. The fun part about it is when you go in as an anybody, I don't care what you are, any paid temporary contractor, what they did, I don't know if they still do it anymore, but they used to bring you into it was just like a little tutorial on how the place works. And they showed you, on this big screen on pretty much what goes on, you know, in a couple of the buildings where anything would happen. They show you what would happen, and then they tell you the lights. When the lights go on, this happens. You got to clear the area, and it's really a safety tutorial that they give you, but. You know, through it, you got a little lesson on how this place works. And depending on which building you went into, you would get that information. So, when I finished up there, I didn't want to leave. I wanted to chain myself to the building. Dick, back to you.
Yep, I know that feeling. The energy of the beam itself is rated, you've been calling it higher voltage. It's called electron volt. If I have one single electron and I put it in between two plates where there is 1 volt of difference between the two plates, in theory you know the mass of the electron, you know the amount of charge is on that electron, you know the voltage that's on your two plates. Therefore, when the electron moves from the negative plate toward the positive plate, it's moving through a known electrostatic field. It has a known amount of mass, a known amount of charge. A known amount of force is created when that electron is in that field. So therefore, you know the exact velocity that you get out of it. Well, eventually, as you raise the voltage and keep doing this cyclically around the ring, pretty soon you start running into relativism. In other words, as the electron approaches the speed of light, the amount of energy that's in that electron that you used to call velocity starts becoming energy of mass increase. So when you start getting into the tevatron, million is mega, giga is billion, tera is 10 to the 12, these are all exponential mathematics. 10 to the 6, we call that a megavolt, 10 to the 6 volts, 10 to the 9 volts, we would call that a gigavolt. 10 to the 12 volts, we would call that a teravolt. So 10 to the 12 volts that you accelerate that electron through, you would know exactly what energy it has. It's no longer energy because it increases in velocity, but things that start getting close to the speed of light act as if they are heavier. So it becomes a more massive object in theory, moving at close to the speed of light, and when it smashes into a target, you get all of that energy back again, and they measure that in electron volts. So the way you rate the size of your particle accelerator machine is in electron volts, and that's the number you were talking about. Electron volts of, let's call it kinetic energy, of the individual protons, in this case, of that particular beam. And if I've got a million electron volt beam going clockwise in a ring, and I got a million electron volt beam going counterclockwise, and at some particular point in the ring, I allow those two beams to come together, collide head on. The thing that's a little bit amazing about this one is that one megavolt electron volt to the right, one megavolt electron volt to the left, when they collide, the energy is 2 million electron volts. You add them arithmetically. You would think you would do some kind of a square law. If it was ordinary velocities, it would be a kind of a square law. But the way these relativistic particles operate, as I remember, it's a linear law of addition. So you double the power of the machine, of the collision, by having them move in opposite directions. Now, why do you do this? and I'm going to give you a couple of words on this one. This is my theory. I may have a couple of the details wrong, but the assembled group here is going to rapidly correct me. So here's what I think is going on. Every one of us have seen meteors and meteorites during a meteor shower. We've watched particles dive at 100,000 mile velocity, so to speak, into our atmosphere at nighttime during a meteor shower. You see a streak of light as that meteor encounters the atmosphere, experiences a tremendous amount of heat, and burns up and leaves a vapor trail. And if you're a 2-meter meteor scatter enthusiast, you aim your antennas at the right direction, you make a schedule with somebody, and for a few seconds you reflect your 2-meter signal off of that ionized, burned-up meteor trail, and therefore the signal goes way beyond the horizon. It becomes a kind of ionosphere that works at the 2-meter frequency. Ordinary ionosphere doesn't have a maximum usable frequency that goes anywhere near that high. Now, you take every friend you've got and ask them, where's all that heat coming from when the meteor at 100,000 or 500,000 miles an hour strikes the atmosphere and you see that streak of light as it burns up? Where's the heat coming from? 99% of the people you talk to will say, it's friction. It's hitting the air at a real high velocity, and it's causing friction. That's where the heating is coming from. Good sounding answer. And if you're thinking very macroscopically, zoomed way back, it's an answer that sort of works, but it's not accurate. It turns out that every air molecule, your oxygen, your nitrogen, your hydrogen, every one of those molecules that make up the atmosphere, really has a nucleus of protons and neutrons, an electron cloud going around every one of those molecules of air. And that electron cloud has an extremely strong electrostatic repulsion. Two molecules of air coming side by side cannot touch each other. That electron cloud has such a strong negative and negative charge repelling each other. Very similar to what happens when you put two north poles of a magnet, a bar magnet, together. You feel that repulsion. Well, the electron cloud going around each molecule will not allow those molecules to touch each other. Essentially, no molecule of air ever touches any other molecule of air. Once you realize that is going on at the microscopic level, you suddenly realize that this meteor striking the atmosphere does not experience friction. Those molecules are not touching the meteorite. The individual molecules that are in the leading edge of the meteor striking the atmosphere, do not touch each other. However, the leading edge of that shock wave in front of that meteor is being compressed. You compress air molecules, they get hot. Just like when you operate your bicycle pump to pump up your bicycle tire or your car tire, the bottom of the pump gets hot because you're compressing air. Whenever you compress air, it gets hot. P equals NRT. You know, I forget whose law that is. But we've all learned that in our chemistry classes. Compressed air molecules, they get hot. What does hot mean? They got more kinetic energy of the molecules. They move faster when you push them close together. And I can explain that, but I wouldn't go there right now. Somebody want to make a comment on that one?
Good question. Paul,
say that again, Paul.
I think that was Lenz. Isn't that thermodynamics? Lenz?
Good guess. No, it's not Lenz's law. Lenz's law is the one that talks about a changing magnetic field inducing a current in a closed-loop wire around it. That's Lenz's law. What's the name of the law? P equals NRT. Not Avogadro. Can't think of the name of it. Okay, we don't have any good chemistry enthusiasts on campus here tonight. However, we'll find out the name of that one.
Boyle?
Boyle? I don't think it's Boyle. It might be Boyle's, but I don't think so. One of those famous guys way back in the 1600s came up with this. Might be Boyle's law. Anyhow, so what I'm getting at is the air molecules are being compressed at the leading edge of the shock wave of the meteor hitting the atmosphere. Same thing happens with the SR-71 super spy plane. The skin of it heats up because it's striking the air at a very high velocity. But it is compressing air molecules. So, since molecules moving freely have a charge, and they won't touch each other because of that charge of repulsion, how do you really find out what's inside the molecule? How do you smash a molecule to find out what's inside? I mean, if I've got a chunk of rock in my hand and I want to know what's inside of it, I would put it on my anvil and hit it with a hammer, break it into smaller and smaller pieces. Eventually I get a powder. I put those powder chunks under a microscope and I know what's inside of that rock. By smashing things, it's one approach, a destructive approach, process, but at least one approach to find out what's inside of something. You want to find out what's inside of a molecule, you want to smash the molecule. But you can't smash a molecule because you try to bring two of them together, they won't touch because of the electrostatic repulsion. However, the amount of electrostatic repulsion is finite. If I've got one set of molecules in the form of my sheet of gold leaf I'm using as a target, and I got one other set of molecules inside of my particle accelerator that I've accelerated to one tera electron volt of velocity, I now have enough energy in that beam coming out of my particle accelerator, striking my gold leaf target in my particular experiment, where now there's enough energy, enough velocity, that when they come together, they do strike each other. I now have overcome the electrostatic repulsion of that cloud of electrons, if it's a complete molecule, or the electrostatic repulsion of the protons, if I'm smashing protons. If I move them fast enough, I will force them to touch each other. I'll break up the bundle of protons that was the previous nucleus of that particular molecule. After I break up that nucleus by that impact onto my target, and now I study the particles that come flying out of there. I find out what was there. Those individual particles, once I've smashed them separated them from each other, then I've got the right kind of three-dimensional detectors, and I study what the detector is telling me, I can run the experiment backwards in my mind, in my computer program, and find out what was originally there. So, as you build a particle accelerator of higher and higher energy, you can now get to smaller and smaller pieces, so to speak. I'm now using a more and more precise hammer to smash my rock into smaller and smaller pieces, and I'm getting more and more microscopic to find out what was really inside of my rock, in my particular metaphor. And that's what these big particle accelerators are doing. You can start seeing smaller and smaller inner space, so to speak, because as you get down to the smaller and smaller particles, it takes more and more energy to smash that particular portion of it, because you've got to bring individual subparticles that have charge on them in many cases, closer and closer together, and it takes more energy to do it. So you get finer and finer details of what was inside of a molecule when you use more and more energy of a bigger and bigger machine to do that collision process. That's what these particle accelerators are doing, in my opinion. I guarantee I've got some of the details wrong, but I think you can see somewhat of the process that's going on here. Okay? There must be a bunch of guys saying, boy, he's got that backwards. So, give me your call letters right now and correct the errors I just made. K2RIW listening.
KT2OES.
Frank recognized. Anyone else? Fred recognized. Recognized. Anyone else?
WS2M.
And Paul recognized in that order. Fred first. Go ahead, Fred.
Stephen Hawking will be on the Science Channel at 11, the IF Direct TV, and he's revising his theory on black holes, so just for information.
I believe it was Stephen Hawking that said that as the black hole gets smaller and smaller, because of evaporation, black holes do slowly evaporate. As they get smaller and smaller, the rate of evaporation increases, I think, exponentially, so that these microscopic black holes that people are worried about, that our particle accelerator, the LHC, might create, because they're so darn small, they would evaporate in nanoseconds or picoseconds or femtoseconds, is my interpretation, even if you did create a microscopic black hole, if such a thing was possible. So I believe it was Hawking that talked about the evaporation process of a black hole. I wonder if you happen to know, Fred, is that the portion of his theory that he's modifying? KC2OES, K2LIW.
That I can't tell you, but I have a question while I'm on the air here. And my question is, isn't the actual bottom line for the collider to find the particles that are smaller than the quarks? Am I correct?
You got it. As you use more and more energy, you're doing a finer and finer pulverizing of the individual molecule, and you're finding the particles that are inside of the particles, so to speak.